Andrea. I'm from the Ohio State University. I just want to say thank you so much for hosting me here. My trip's been fantastic. I'm sad that it's so short because this really is a wonderful place, and I've enjoyed my stay. Okay, and like I said, I'm going to be showing some of the recent results within the Fermilab collaboration for our indirect searches for dark matter with the Fermi Large Area Telescope. So outline, first I'm just going to give a very basic dark matter overview. You know, how do we go about doing an indirect search? What are the motivations for why are we looking for dark matter? What kind of dark matter could we possibly see with for the Fermilab? I'll then go and describe the instrument and some of the features of our instrument response functions to give you an idea of like what our sensitivity levels are. Then I'm just going to talk about the gamma ray sky in general that's observed by the Fermilab, because there's really a lot of interesting physics beyond just looking for a dark matter signal that we can do. And then I'll focus on some of the recent results in the dark matter sector with a focus on the spectral line search, which is the search that I work on. Okay, so there is an overwhelming amount of astrophysical evidence for dark matter, which I'm sure many of you in this room are familiar with. But just to remind you, some of the first evidence came in 1937 when Fritz Vicky just applied the Virial theorem to the coma cluster and said there is not enough mass to keep this system gravitationally bound. And at the time, it was thought that perhaps that additional mass could come from, you know, non-stellar things like gas, and we didn't need to introduce new physics yet. There was a similar argument made regarding the galactic rotation curves, and this was sort of spearheaded by Vera Rubin in the 80s, where they looked at the velocity of stars as a function of their distance from the galactic center. And if you just use Newtonian gravity, you'd expect that to fall off as you get further away from the central luminous distribution of matter. But they saw that that actually tends to kind of plateau, and that this was a common feature from many, many galaxies. So this also suggests that there has to be this extra mass in order to keep the system gravitationally bound, and that that mass is kind of clumping in this giant halo around these galaxies, and that this is dark. We do have evidence from the Bullitt cluster suggesting that dark matter is pretty collisionless. And so what we show here is the colored here is from Chandra data. It's X-rays. This is showing where the baryonic matter is interacting. So just to remind you, the Bullitt cluster was a galaxy cluster merger. So two galaxies had come together, they passed through each other, and then we're observing them after they passed through. And so the Chandra data shows how the baryonic matter got stuck in the middle because it started interacting with itself. But then you can do a weak lensing survey and say, well, where is the gravity in the system? And that's what those green contours are showing. And so what you're seeing is that most of the particles that were making up the matter just passed right on through without interacting, while the baryonic stuff got stuck in the middle. And to demonstrate that, I have a little movie. The blue here is sort of the dark matter halo, and the red would be the gas of the system. And you can see that as they pass through each other, the red gets stuck in the middle, and the blue just sort of go through without interacting with each other. OK, and then we also can look at the acoustic oscillations in the CMB and do a fit to that with our best lambda CDM model. And that's just telling us that the baryonic matter is not enough to make that model work, and we need these non-baryonic dark matter contribution. All right, so an example of what dark matter could be, it could be a particle, and it could be a weakly interacting massive particle or a WIMP. This is what we're predominantly looking for with the Fermilab. These are particles at the GeV to TeV mass scale. We have to make some assumptions. We assume that they can annihilate or decay and produce standard matter particles, because that's what we can observe. And we also typically assume that there's one population that accounts for most or all of the dark matter density. We don't really take into account separate populations right now. We're just making this basic assumption that there's one kind of particle that's making up most of it. And an example would be a neutralino, although this is kind of falling out of favor these days with some of the constraints coming out of the LHC. But particles like this are predicted in many SUSY models, and they give us a lot of properties that we need for these WIMPs, like being electrically neutral, being stable, because you've got to form those halos, and having the right mass scale. So the W part of WIMP is weakly interacting. Why do we talk about that? Well, we can assume that what if this is a thermal relic? So what if this particle was in creation and annihilation equilibrium in the early universe? As the universe expands and gets cooled off, the creation part turns off. And then as the expansion of the universe makes things get further and further apart, the annihilation turns off. And that freezes out the amount of dark matter left over in the universe after this process. And that's called the relic abundance. And what's pretty amazing is that, which is some simple assumptions of a pretty heavy mass scale like GVTV mass particle and a weak scale interaction for the annihilation cross section, the predicted relic abundance is about 23%, which is what we observe in the from the CMB data. And so this sort of agreement between theory and experiment, in this case, heavily motivates looking for a weak scale particle. And I just also want to mention that we do typically talk about cold dark matter, so we assume that it's nearly at rest and it's at non-relativistic velocities about 0.3c. And this is so that those particles are theorized in the system we're talking about. All right, well, how do you detect WIMPs? Again, we assume that they're going to couple somehow to standard model particles, but here's where the theory comes in, and there's a lot of different models that can fill in that question mark. You can see we can do production, which would be at a collider, where you have, say, at the LHC, proton-proton come together through some mechanism and produce two WIMPs, and then those WIMPs would show up as missing energy in the detector because they would be stable and they wouldn't further decay, so they would just not be observed. You can also do a direct detection where you look for a WIMP scattering off of a heavy nucleon. These are things that go on like the xenon experiment or the Dama experiment. And those are typically underground detectors. And that's also a very interesting story that I'm not going to really get into, because I'm going to be focusing on the indirect detection, where we assume that the WIMPs have interacted and produced these standard model particles, and then that's what we look for, is sort of that indirect signature. So what does that signature look like? Well, you have to remember that when we talk about these indirect searches, we're talking on these astrophysical length scales. So we are not going to see, so say the WIMP annihilates into a BB bar pair. We're not going to see the Bs, because the Bs have to travel, you know, light years, hundreds of light years, thousands of light years to get to us. And so by that time, they have, you know, kind of decayed down their chain. And so what we are going to see are gamma rays, neutrinos, and maybe things like electrons and positrons and protons. And so then, if we do see a signal we can attribute to dark matter, disentangling the intrinsic particle properties from that signal can be quite challenging. Another special signal, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, is the WIMP annihilation directly into two gamma rays, or into a gamma ray and some neutral boson. This is going to give you a line. This is going to give you a signal at one specific energy. That energy is related to the WIMP mass. And so this signal is much easier to disentangle kind of what those WIMP properties are from if we see that. All right, so how do we do this? Well, I have this kind of main equation of indirect dark matter searches. On the left-hand side is the flux. This is what we're observing. This is just the number of gamma rays, in the case of the Fermilat, per centimeter squared per second. This is a function of energy, and it's a function of the region of interest, so where you decide to look. You can look in the entire sky. You can just look in some specific dwarf galaxy targets, say, where you expect your signal to noise to be pretty good. All right, and so what makes up what we can observe? This red part is the particle physics part, where we have the cross section. This is typically what you would solve for in your search. So this is a pretty big unknown. We suspect maybe it's at the weak scale, but it doesn't have to be. And then we have the DNDE of gamma rays that you would expect from whichever annihilation or decay channel you're considering. And then, of course, the associated branching fraction. The second part is the astrophysics part, and this is an integral over your line of sight of the distribution of dark matter in the galaxy. And I just really want to emphasize that the distribution of dark matter in the dark matter distribution in the galaxy is very uncertain at this time. There can be a large variation as far as central cuspiness, which I'll show in the next slide. And this just gives you an example of what we suspect the dark matter density distribution might be. This is from a simulation, and this is just one realization. So every time you do this, things can, where these little like clumps that you see here can move around. So we don't know where the clumps are supposed to be. We do suspect that there is this substructure, and we also suspect that there is a big, big, big clump right at the center of the galaxy. So that's kind of what we know. And then also, this just sort of describes what a line of sight integral is. When you're looking at the sky, you're really looking at a spherical surface. In any direction you look in, you're looking at all the gamma rays that are between you and the end of the universe. And so if you're saying, how much dark matter did I expect to see, you have to do this integral from 0 out to pretty much infinity. That's a line of sight. OK, so like I mentioned, the central cuspiness of the dark matter distribution is relatively unknown. These are some smooth dark matter density profiles. These don't include the substructure as a function of radius from the galactic center, and you can just see the amount of variation that we expect. And so this is a pretty big unknown in dark matter searches. Okay, so that's what we're looking for, why we're looking for it, and now I'll tell you about the instrument that we use. So the Fermi Large Area Telescope is just one instrument on board the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, which launched in June 2008, and so we've been taking data for just over 4 years now, or near five. And we were originally a five-year mission, but our mission has been extended. We recently asked them if we can just keep going, and they said, yes, you guys are doing great. We've been extended through at least 2016 with, of course, regular reviews to make sure we're still doing great things. So that's really exciting, and we do hope to be a 10-year mission when all is said and done. And so here's kind of a schematic of what the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope is. This is the LAT, which is what I'm going to be talking about, but I just also want to point out the Gamma Ray Burst Monitor, the GBM. That's the second instrument on board that looks for gamma ray bursts. The LAT it can observe the gamma ray sky from 20 MeV to 300 GeV and greater, and it's really a survey instrument. It sees 20% of the sky at any given time. The field of view is huge. Oh, and it can observe the entire sky every 3 hours. So how does it work? Well, it's a pair-convergent telescope. So what happens is a gamma ray comes in, the first half of the instrument is a tracker, and every other layer is silicon, and then the other layer is tungsten. Tungsten's a high-Z material so that we can really get this QED process going where the gamma ray will convert into an electron and positron pair. And so you can see that this mechanism turns on around 20 MeV. That explains our lower energy limit. We need the gamma ray to pair convert for us to be able to observe it. And so then what we're really tracking is the electron and the positron pair, and then they go and hit the calorimeter, and that's where we measure their energy. So we're not really directly observing the gamma ray, we're observing it after it's pair converted. Okay. Yeah, it depends with energy, of course. Right at the 20 MeV, not all of them go. But yeah, once it starts turning on, yeah. The thickness of the instrument is something like 10 radiation lengths. So the gamma ray is pretty much going to pair convert and be absorbed by our instrument. Yeah, including the calorimeter. The tracker is probably about 2. I think the calorimeter is 8.6. 1.5. Correct. Yep, silicon. And they're, you got the X and the Y, and then the depth gives you the Z. So it's a three-dimensional imaging tracker. All right, this is just kind of a drawing of the different pieces of the LAT. I just want to say the Fermilat collaboration is an international collaboration of about 400 scientists. You can see the different nations involved. And our data is public, and it's typically made public within 24 hours of getting taken. So the data you can download online, this Fermi data, is the freshest, most recent data that you can get. We've worked really hard to get a pipeline that goes smoothly so that we can get that data to you guys quick. The outermost part is called the ACD, or the anti-coincidence detector. It is just a bunch of scintillator tiles. And what happens is a charged particle will leave a signature here, but a gamma ray, which is neutral, will not. And we need to do this because our charged particle rate is 1,000 to 10,000, depending on energy, times larger than our gamma ray rate. So we're getting hit with these cosmic rays way more often than gamma rays. And so we need to have this kind of a veto on the outside in order to help us tease out the gamma ray signal from the large cosmic ray background. And it's very, very efficient, as it needs to be. So the first part is the tracker. I already talked a lot about that. And so then we can move on to the calorimeter. This is hotoscopic, so that just kind of means Lincoln logs. And that also gives us directional information. So we get a 3D reconstruction of the shower shape in the calorimeter, which helps us get directional information at higher energy. And then there is an onboard trigger, which I'll talk about a little bit in the coming slides. And we do have a pretty rudimentary software filter on board because we have to get our downlink rate to 300 hertz, because that's how much we can, that's our bandwidth to get to the Earth. So we get hit with about 10 kilohertz is our trigger request rate, and then we got to get that down, which we do with our onboard trigger and our software filter. All right, so you can define the performance of the Fermi Large Area Telescope with things called instrument response functions. One of them is the effective area. This is really kind of like the acceptance, if you want to think of it that way. It's a function of both energy and incident angle. So I showed on the previous slide, the incident angle is just the angle relative to the normal of the lat that the incoming gamma ray had. And you can see that at the lower energies, we turn on around 20 MeV. This is not only limited by needing a pair conversion, but it's also limited. We have one of our trigger requirements is to have 3 hits in a row in the tracker. If the event pair converted and pittered out before it gave us 3 hits, we don't have any information about it, so we just throw it out. It's not interesting. We can't really learn anything from it. At the larger energies, the rejection starts to come from our cuts. So we call these photon classes. Right here, we're showing here the past 7 source photon class acceptance. These are just the cuts that we use to define if the event was a gamma ray or not. And at the highest energies, we start to get limited by something called backsplash, which is where the event comes in, it hits the calorimeter, and then it splashes up a bunch of like delta rays, and then those get into electrons and positrons, and they just mess up the image in the tracker because you have all this splash, backsplash. So it's really hard to find your track. And so at greater than 100 GeV, our image is just really messy, and it's hard to get the information out, so we just have to throw those events out. Also, at these higher energies, we are limited by saturation in the calorimeter, and so where we can really only get a lower limit to the energy. And so there's really only so much you can do with those. So these are just kind of the limitations of the detector. You can also see that the effective area or the acceptance dies pretty quickly with the incident angle. So if you're coming in at too high of an incident angle, say you're only going through the tracker or only going through the calorimeter, at this point, we would throw that out. And so you can see that once you're above 60 degrees incident angle, we throw those events out. I'm going to get to that in 2 slides. So the next one is a point spread function. This is how well the lat can absorb a point source, or our spatial sensitivity. And this is a function of energy. At the lowest energies, you can see that we're up rather high. And this is because of multiple scattering in the tracker, so it's harder to get the pointing information as accurately. And at the highest energies, we're just limited by the physical design of the lat. We have our pitch of the silicon tracker part set by the hardware, and that's where our limitation is. But to show you just how much this PSF can vary, this is Vela. It's a pulsar, so that is a true point source in the sky. This is a 10 by 10 degree counts map, and these are in these different energy bands. So you can see just how great our pointing gets at these highest energies, and how the PSF does get a little bad at the lower energies, and so that's a challenge for if you're looking at a low energy source. All right, energy dispersion, or energy resolution as promised. This is if there were a line at just one energy, how well can Fermi measure that? And it's also a function of energy and incident angle. At the lower energies, we have issues because there's energy loss in the tracker before it hits our calorimeter. Calorimeter is primarily what we use to measure the energy, and we do try to correct for the amount lost in the tracker, but you know, we can only do so well. Be realistic, I suppose. And yeah, so at the lower energies, that's really what's driving the 25% there. You can see we hit a sweet spot, and then at the larger energies, we start to have issues with calsaturation, which I talked about, and also leakage, where the shower and the calorimeter isn't fully contained within the lat. Maybe we only capture 50% of it because the way that the event came in and the size of the shower shape. And we do try to correct for that as much as we can, but you can see that at most, our energy resolution is less than 10%. But you can say, like, on average, if you're talking about more than 1 GeV, you can probably quote 10% as your energy resolution, which is really great. Correct. The resolutions, no, they don't change too much going from source to clean. Yeah, so it would be the acceptance. So if you were looking at the source class, it would be below this curve. The clean class. So clean would be tighter cuts the source class are cuts defined specifically for a gamma ray source. So we assume that you're already cutting spatially by looking in a certain direction in the sky where you know there's a source, so you don't need to be too harsh with your cuts. But then if you're looking in the diffuse, then you're not quite sure then you don't have that spatial cut already applied, and so you need to be a little bit harsher about if you're going to define if it's a gamma ray or not. So the effective area would be below that. Okay, so let's talk about the gamma ray sky that we observe with the Fermi LAT. This just shows you what the sky looks like on a day-to-day basis. So this is really showing that this is a dynamic sky, right? You see these counts maps and they look rather static, but it's not. The gamma ray sky is changing all the time. You can see sources flaring up and going away. This is the northern and southern galactic hemisphere, so the galactic plane you can't really see because it's on the edge of this. And I just want to point out, maybe you saw, it's a little hard because the lights are on, but there's a moving source here. You see it? That is the sun, in case you didn't know. And so the sun is typically not that bright in gamma rays. However, when it flares, and it's starting to reach a solar activity maximum, so we're getting more and more of these flares, the sun can be the brightest gamma ray source in the sky. And this is an example of a flare that we observed in March that made the APOD, the astronomy picture of the day. This is what the counts map looked like the day before the flare and the day after the flare. And you can see that the sun was even brighter than Vela. And there is a group within Fermi and people outside the collaboration who are studying the gamma rays from the sun and from these flares and trying to learn more about the inner structure of the sun. So this is kind of something else you can do with Fermi that maybe you wouldn't have immediately thought, like, oh, we can look at gamma rays from the sun and learn some neat things about that. All right, so here is, if you just kind of added everything up, after 1 year of observation, this is what our sky map looks like above one GeV. Just to show you how much better things are in year five, here's the four-year map. You see how much sharper things get? And what I want you to take away from this picture is that nature has given us a very rich and very complicated gamma ray sky. There's a lot going on. Maybe one of the first things you notice is this bright galactic plane. Here's the galactic center, and that's full of different sources and diffuse that are making these gamma rays. Then we have off the plane, there's also a complicated diffuse structure and more sources. There's also an isotropic component coming from extragalactic sources. And then on top of all of that, we're going to be looking for a very small piece from dark matter. So really the challenge in a dark matter search comes from disentangling the expected small dark matter piece from this large, complicated astrophysical background. And it really is quite challenging. All right, but challenging, we do it anyway because it's important and it's highly motivated. So we do look for these dark matter results because we are sensitive to regions of dark matter phase space that are very interesting. And so let me talk about some of the recent results from the Fermi-LAT collaboration. So here's just an overview of some of the searches that we can do. So we don't just look for dark matter in one way. We look for it in a variety of ways. And each of these different search analyses has its advantages and its disadvantages. So say you want to just look in the galactic center. Oh, just so you know, this plot is another realization of the dark matter distribution in the galaxy. So what's being shown here is the kind of expected intensity from dark matter annihilation. So there's no astrophysical background here. So you could go and look in the galactic center. That's where you expect most of the dark matter signal to be, because it's supposed to be peaked in the center. And you get lots of statistics. Galactic center is bright, but the galactic center is very complicated. And so this is a place where your astrophysical background is very challenging, and you have to be careful. You could also go and look in the entire galaxy if you want to look at the whole sky. But again, you're challenged by your astrophysical background. You could say, all right, well, I know that there are these dwarf galaxies where they're very dark, so I imagine it to be mostly dark matter dominated. So I can go just look in those points in the skies for gamma rays. And here we go. So this would be looking for this local density enhancement. And we know of a couple targets that we've looked at. Let's see, you could also look in the extragalactic, so the isotropic component of your gamma rays, and look for dark matter from there. And you can also look, so Fermi's a gamma ray telescope, but you saw that we're doing this pair conversion. So Fermi can also see electrons and positrons. Typically, we veto those with that ACD, but if we just flip that switch and say, oh, no, actually, we're going to keep the events that trigger in the ACD and look like electrons and positrons, then we can measure those as well. So it's not just a gamma ray instrument. And that's the first thing I'm going to talk about. So Fermi has measured the electron-positron spectrum. Why is this interesting? A previous experiment, ATTIC, observed a pretty narrow bump over the expected electron-positron spectrum. So this is the energy spectrum. The dashed line here just shows pretty much the best model for what we expect the spectrum to be like, given what we know about what's making electrons and positrons at these high energies, and Attic saw this narrow bump that was unexpected. And that was weird, because narrow things are usually very strange at these gamma rays, at the highest energies. We expect things to be pretty smooth power laws. So Fermi went off to see if we can confirm that. And the red points here are the Fermi observations. And you can see that we do see a slight excess above the model, but it's not nearly this like sharp feature like what Attic was seeing. And so you can say, all right, well, now I can just tweak some of the maybe cosmic ray injection spectrum from different sources to bring this model up to fit the data. Or how else could you get high energy electron positrons? You could have a leptophilic dark matter annihilating and giving you a bunch, because the dark matter is heavy. So the annihilation products, the electrons and positrons from those, are going to be very energetic. So perhaps there's dark matter that's giving you this broad excess at high energies. But this does have some problems with it. And we're going to see that some of our limits have put some strong constraints on this sort of leptophilic dark matter models. Well, I guess if it's producing this many, like if this whole excess was from dark matter, then this would have to be something that dark matter does a lot of the time, right? Because if it only did it rarely, then it would be a very small component. We wouldn't expect this big of an excess. That's also, yes. Right, yeah, that's a good point. Right, we had, Right, yeah, so there's constraints on the protons that make it have to be leptophilic. Okay, so something else that's kind of weird with the electron and positron spectrum is the positron fraction as a function of energy. So you might say to yourself, all right, well, how could Fermi distinguish between electrons and positrons if it doesn't have a magnet on board? Right, so there's no magnet on board Fermi. But we are orbiting a giant magnet. We are orbiting the Earth. And we can use the Earth's magnetic field to identify times in Fermi's orbit where it will only be or mostly be accepting electrons and not positrons, because the positrons would be spiraled into the Earth or shielded by the Earth's magnetic field. So I think that's actually kind of neat. And so then we can go off and measure the positron fraction, which we have. Why is that interesting? Well, Pamela, went off and measured this as well, and they saw that at these higher energies, the positron fraction started to increase, which is weird, because positrons, these guys, since they're antimatter, they're coming from relatively nearby, right? Because if the positron came from too far away, it would have annihilated before it got to Fermi. And so we would really be expecting these to be produced as secondaries during cosmic ray interactions nearby, and so we should expect the number of positrons that we're getting to start to decrease with energy. And it looks like that's not the case. And so what's giving us these extra positrons at high energies? Well, you could start to tweak your models about the injection spectrum or add some more nearby sources. Or you could also explain this with dark matter annihilation. Because you'll notice this positron fraction here is 10%, and it goes up from there. And so if you have the annihilation, you're making electron and positrons in equal amounts, and you start doing that more and more at high energies, then you would expect this fraction to start to increase from 10%. All right, so let's get back to gamma rays. But just to highlight that Fermi, we do look at the electrons and positrons as well. These are the results from a study of the Milky Way halo. We limited our search here in these two rectangles. These were chosen so that we were getting the diffuse part of the gamma ray sky, but we wanted to go off the plane because the galactic plane is very noisy. The astrophysical background is challenging to disentangle the dark matter signal from. So we did that, and what happened was, we did this search, but the uncertainties in our background modeling ended up kind of causing this dark matter piece to try to fill in those uncertainties. And so that was giving us trouble. And we said, okay, we're not seeing a residual that looks like dark matter. We're not seeing a residual that has this sort of centrally peaked spatial distribution. So what we're going to do with this analysis is we say, we can't see dark matter. Let's go set limits. And so that's what we did. And these are the limits that we've set with this analysis. The blue line, so these are limits for annihilation into BB bar. And this is for decay into BB bar. And the blue line here are the most conservative limits you can imagine, where we say every gamma ray we saw in those regions came from dark matter. Which, yes, so that's a very conservative assumption. The black limits, however, are the limits we derive from marginalizing over the uncertainties in the background modeling as well as trying to set limits. So you should really be focusing on the black ones, but if you really wanted to be conservative and about it, then perhaps the blue ones are for you. But you can see that these black limits, here is that weak scale cross-section that gives that 23% relic density. You can see that we're starting to exclude these light, you know, less than 30 GeV WIMPs who annihilate only to BB bar. We should have seen something, and we didn't. So we're starting to exclude models that predict that large of a cross-section. And that's a really interesting benchmark to be at. All right, so that was the BB bar channel. This is the leptonic channel, so this would be annihilation or decay into taus. And what's also plotted here, so same thing you can see here with the taus. We're starting to exclude into that thermal relic cross-section at below about 30 GeV. And what's shown in these contours here are models that could explain that electron to positron excess and anomalies that I talked about earlier. And so you can see that if there were dark matter that were annihilating to electrons and positrons that much to explain those anomalies, we should have been able to see gamma rays with this search, and we did not. And so I guess here, not everything is excluded, but they are heavily disfavored by this analysis. All right, we also look at the dwarf galaxies. So these are galaxies that are very dark, so the mass to light ratio is very high. So we expect these things to be dark matter dominated. And the guys we use in our search are in the white diamonds. You'll notice that those are all mostly off the plane. So again, we're really trying to avoid the galactic plane where the astrophysical background is very challenging. And we use, I believe, 12? 10. Order of magnitude. So we look at 10 dwarf galaxies and we do a joint likelihood analysis. Because when you look for limits from just one galaxy, you can't do very great. But if you combine them all together, then the limits get pretty good. And this shows the results from that search. What's also plotted here is the expected 68 and 95% containment for a, you know, no, not having a dark matter in your model expectation. And what's also shown here are limits from other dwarf galaxy searches from Hess and Veritas. And what this is just showing is how you really need these cross-collaboration analyses, because Fermi can do great at these lower energies, but then you get up here and Hess starts to do a lot better. And so you really need to start to work together with a lot of these different instruments to really probe all of the dark matter phase space. And you can also see that though this is for BB bar, let me show you the limits from all the channels. You can see that in this analysis, we're also starting to exclude at that thermal relic cross-section. And in this analysis, it's below about 10 GeV. So we're really starting to probe down into an interesting part of WIMP phase space. And you might ask yourself, all right, well, we've done this great study with the dwarfs. Is that all we can get out of the dwarfs? And the answer is absolutely not. There's still a lot of information we can learn from the dwarfs in the future. And this just shows some of the projected limits, if there is no dark matter, that we would expect to be able to set after 10 years. We would assume that after 10 years, we found some more targets that we want to look at, so using 30 dwarfs. Then we'd assume that after 10 years of observation, perhaps they can become spatially extended sources. That can give us some more information. So you can see we expect the dwarf analysis to really start to probe deep at all of these mass ranges into this thermal relic cross-section. So you should really look forward to more great results from a dwarf analysis. As we start to improve things. And this isn't including, well, I guess this is including some analysis improvements, but maybe improvements in background modeling aren't really included here. So that will make things even better. So there's recently some excitement regarding the Virgo cluster. This is a galaxy cluster. A group led by Han said they saw about a 4 sigma excess that they could attribute to dark matter. So this is a counts map of the Virgo galaxy cluster. And then if you subtract some kind of model with your diffuse background as well as the sources in this cluster, this was sort of the leftover residual. You can see how it kind of looks a lot like those dark matter maps, the smooth dark matter maps we were looking at earlier. And so they claimed a very significant possible dark matter signal from Virgo. However, at the Fermi-LAT collaboration, the excitement from Virgo kind of went away. There were many updates given. One was by this other group, and Han also had a similar result, where they said, OK, well, we were only subtracting the gamma ray sources from your 2-year catalog, but it looks like after 4 years, there are some new source candidates. And so maybe those sources are giving us that extra access that we were attributing to dark matter. And also the Fermilab collaboration, we showed that if you look at the test statistic after that background subtraction, the excess that you see is significantly removed from the cluster center. And you'd really expect the dark matter component to be close to the center of your system. Also, the Fermilab collaboration, we showed that if you start to tweak your kind of diffuse model, your interstellar model, that you could account for the excess as well. And we were tweaking things within the uncertainties of the models. And so really what came out of that was that maybe Virgo isn't the best place to be looking for dark matter because it's so complicated, and the signal that we're maybe seeing is of order the uncertainties in our model, our background models. So unfortunately, some of the excitement around Virgo has gone away. All right. Yeah. So now we get to the search for gamma ray spectral lines, which I'm sure many of you have perhaps heard about. There's been some recent excitement with these sorts of searches. And what we're looking for here is, like I said, WIMP annihilation directly into gamma rays or a gamma ray in a neutral boson. This gives you a monochromatic signal. So this would give you, this is the DNDE as a function of WIMP mass. And you can see there can be some broadening at lower energies due to the Z width, but for the most part, these guys are going and making gamma rays at one energy. You expect your background to be more or less a power loss. So if you start making a bunch of gamma rays at one specific energy, you get a pile up at that energy, and you get a line. So that's what we're looking for. And really, one of the great things about this sort of an analysis is that it's a sharp, distinct feature. So it should be pretty easy to disentangle from the background. One of the disadvantages is you may notice that this is a loop-suppressed process. WIMPs do not easily couple the photons, thus they are dark. And so the branching fraction of this is expected to be very low. And so we expect the signal to be small. So the Fermilab team, our two-year analysis accepted for publication in PRD this last spring, so almost a year ago. And the four-year analysis is mostly complete, and we're working on getting the draft complete for that analysis. What we used for our data set was a reprocessed data set and using the clean cuts. So what happened was, and this was expected and very small effect, is the light yield from our calorimeter logs. There was a slow degradation just from radiation damage from being in an environment that kept getting hit by cosmic rays. And also the asymmetry of that light in the calorimeter, we used that to get directional information. And so that was also being affected by this radiation damage. And so we knew about this, and we have recently put in a correction for it in our event reprocess or our event reconstruction, and we reprocessed everything. So now we have the reprocessed data set has corrected for this effect, so it has improved the energy measurement at the higher energies. And what it's really done is it's shifted the energy scale up by a few percent, as we would expect. So like I said, this is a small effect, but on a line analysis where the energy resolution is very important, this is a relevant upgrade to our data set. And the reprocessed data is currently not publicly available, but we hope it will be publicly available very soon. So we're hoping maybe by the end of February. Okay, so that's the reprocessing. We specifically used the clean class because we wanted the tight cuts since we weren't looking at a specific source. So we wanted to be very, very sure that we were looking at gamma rays and that we had a low cosmic ray background. We searched for lines from 5 to 300 GeV using a maximum likelihood fit. We used these sliding energy windows, and we fit in steps of the energy resolution. In that way, we were trying to not step over potential signals. What we did is we modeled the background as a single power law, and then we looked for deviations that looked like a line on top of that. And these plots here, they just show the results from the two-year line search. I'm going to show the results from the four-year in a little bit. But this just shows an example of what one of our fits looks like at 7 GeV. And here you can see we saw maybe a small wiggle, but nothing very significant. So something we've worked hard on for this analysis is improving our signal model for what an energy resolution should look like. Previously, what was done is you can model the energy dispersion curve. We have a full detector simulation that's a JAINT-based simulation. Give that one energy a million times and then see how it smears things out. And then what we did is we fit a triple Gaussian to try to model the shape of this curve. And we did this at specific energies and then interpolated what the shape would be like at whichever energy we were interested in studying. And so what this didn't take advantage of is there's this other variable that's called probability. I'll call it energy probability, or PCB. And this is a variable that comes out of a classification tree that takes into account a variety of the calorimeter variables that went into the energy reconstruction, spits out a number between 0 and 1. Things closer to 1 means the energy reconstruction was great. The quality was great. There weren't really any problems. Things at a lower probability had some issues, like, say, the saturation, or the leakage, or backsplash. But we didn't want to reject the event, because it's always a challenge between acceptance and purity and quality, right? You don't want to make your cuts too harsh, because then you don't have any events. And so this was one where we decided this isn't the best event in the world, but we're going to keep it anyway, and we'll just tag it with this lower probability so that we know there were maybe some issues. And so you can see that if you look at the energy dispersion in these different probability slices, here's what it looked like in the highest probabilities. So these are the events that were beautiful, very easy to reconstruct, versus the low energies, where there are some issues. And you can see just how different the energy dispersion gets. Things get much broader and negatively biased when they have these low probabilities. So we include this piece of information in our line model. And what it really does is it says, OK, events that had this better reconstruction are sort of weighted more heavily in our fit. We say, OK, you guys came in with this great reconstruction. We expect you to be able to be very narrow. Whereas the guys that come in with the lower probability, we say, OK, you had some problems. We'll expect you to be a little bit broader. And using this additional piece of information gives about a 15% improvement to the sensitivity when there is a line, and also to setting the limits when there is no line. And if you think of setting the limits typically goes a square root of time, then this is pretty much more or less equivalent to adding 33% more data, which is a significant improvement to the analysis. Another thing that we added, and this was motivated by something that Christoph Winninger did in his paper, is we looked at different regions of interest optimized for different dark matter density distributions. So remember, we're not quite sure just how cuspy the dark matter density is in the galactic center. And depending on if we assume a model that's very cuspy or not as cuspy, your optimal region of interest is going to be smaller or bigger. And so what we did is we just took a 12 by 10 box in the galactic center. We found that this was pretty optimal for all of the dark matter profiles that we considered. And then we varied the radius of the circular part of our mask. And then this just kind of plots the relative singular noise as a function of radius for an anasto and FW or isothermal. And so you can see that the anasto, which is more centrally cuspy, prefers a smaller region of interest, and the isothermal prefers a much larger region of interest. So all in all, we consider 5 regions of interest, one that's just that galactic center box, so that we kind of focus in on the galactic center, and then an anasto-optimized NFW isothermal. And then we do one where we take the whole sky, except for that off-center plane, and this would be a region to look for decay. This was also the region of interest used in the 2-year line analysis, so it allowed us to compare the two. All right, so we searched for lines from 5 to 300 GeV in those 5 regions of interest, and we do not see any globally significant lines. This is a function of our local fit significance as a function of energy. That dashed line shows where our global 2 sigma level would be. So we do a trials factor calculation, taking into account the scan over energy and the scan over our ROI. And here, this is 135 GeV. You can see at the lower energies, we do get some somewhat significant fit, but the fractional size of these is of order a few percent. And that's of order the uncertainties in our acceptance or our effective area. So it's very possible that wiggles in that are causing these. So we don't believe that any of these are real signals. And you can see that at 130, we're not getting anything that's terribly globally significant. So consequently, we have set limits. So these are the 95% confidence level flux upper limits in the anasto-optimized ROI, which I plot here. Also, what's plotted in the green and the yellow are the 68%, 95% containment, expected containment bands for a no dark matter hypothesis. These bands are really capturing the statistical variation in your no dark matter hypothesis that we expect in this search. And you can see it's quite large. So you can see things are bouncing around, but they're pretty much bouncing around within those bands. Which is why we're not claiming any signals at this time. You can translate those into a cross-section upper limits, and this is for the ANASTO profile. What's plotted in the blue were the previous limits from the two-year analysis, and so you can see just how much our improved model, our extended exposure, you know, 2 years versus 4 years, and also our ROI optimization, just how much of an improvement those three things give to our limits. So we've really done things a lot more carefully this time. Okay, well, let's talk about this line feature near 130. So I say 135 because with that reprocessing, taking into account that degradation in our calorimeter, it shifts from 130 to 135. So, you know, a few percent doesn't make that much of a difference. And I just want to remind you again that our blind search, we don't see anything globally significant at 135. However, even though we don't see it in any of our a priori regions of interest, what we've done is we said, okay, well, let's just look in a 4x4 degree galactic center box. And let's just really see what's going on. So this is with the unreprocessed data. So this would be the data that's currently publicly available. And this is a fit at 130 GeV. And this is a fit with what I'm going to call a 1D PDF that doesn't use that additional quality of the event reconstruction variable probability. So you can see that when we do this fit, it's about a 4 sigma local. The significance of this fit can go up or down depending on some of your choices. But we're just showing this here to say that, yes, there is something there in the energy spectrum. You know, it's not like we missed something. It's there, and people who have seen this at high significance, you know, not doing anything obviously wrong. Right, so I forgot to mention, this is an unbinned fit. So when we do the fit, there is no binning. However, to plot it, I have to give you some binning. So the bin sizes I chose here in energy are somewhat arbitrary. I don't know if that helps answer the question. Right. But so again, in our, if I chose a different binning, then there would be two data points there. The binning that is shown on this plot has absolutely nothing to do with the significance that our fitting finds, because in our fitter, it's an unbinned fit, so everything goes in event by event. We don't do any energy binning. So the binning here is just for plotting purposes only, so really don't take too much away from the fact that it looks like just one bin is high. I'm sorry. We can talk about that later if that's still confusing, but I hope that that was a okay answer. All right, but what I really want to show you is what happens as we make different choices with the fitting. So this is doing the exact same fit, so this 1D fit, but now we're going to use the reprocessed data. So this data has gotten better. The energy reconstruction has gotten better in this data. The acceptance, so the you know, we're not rejecting bad events because they are poor energy reconstruction because of this degradation on calorimeter. So things have gotten better. However, this feature, it shifted to 135 GeV, and it's gone down in significance. So it's gone from 4 sigma to 3.7. So it hasn't gone down that much, but I just want to say it's gone down one. And what I'm trying to do here is just look at this one variable at a time, because there's so many things going on. You really want to see what each thing is doing independently. So then I can go and fit with the 2D fit. So this is including that additional information that should be enhancing the detection of a line, if it's truly a line. And what you can see is the significance goes down even more. And it looks like the fit isn't really matching what's in the data. And it kind of looks like using this additional probability information suggests that the line should be broader than how it appears in the data. And that's what's contributing to the lower significance of this fit, is that the energy probability variable in the data is not what we would expect it to be. And it's not, so the we would expect the line feature to be a little bit broader, and it looks like it's too narrow in the data. Well, so you look at, so say you had all your events were probability of 1, then that should give you a super sharp line. And say all your events were probability of 0.1, then that gives you a broader line. And so we take into account the probability distribution that we see in the data. So we say, okay, here's the distribution. There are so many events at these probabilities. Given that information and convolving with that, so we also take into account we weight it by how many events we see in each probability bin. And we say, okay, well, there were a lot of events in these lower probability bins, so we expect this feature to be wider. And that there is a discrepancy between a very slight discrepancy between the Monte Carlo and the data as far as that distribution goes. It seems in the data at the higher energies, there are less high probability events than we would expect. And so when we model the 1D PDF, we model that using the probability distribution in the Monte Carlo, which seems to say there are more high quality events, thus the line you get from the 1D PDF is narrower. But then if you say, okay, well, I know there's a slight discrepancy, so let's use the probability distribution in the data, that says, oh, the line should actually be a little bit broader. And so that's what this is capturing. And what's not plotted here is there's been an integral over the energy probability variable. Right. Yeah, you can see we're only fitting 16 events here, and before it was, 17 events. So we're not fitting that many less events, but we're getting some more information about the statistical significance from the second dimension in the fit. And that's kind of telling us that things aren't working out, or aren't behaving the way that we would expect. And I also just want to say that we did test our energy resolution with beam tests here on the ground before we went in orbit, and we know our energy reconstruction to 10% or better. So you might say, oh, well, maybe the Monte Carlo is wrong. But our energy Monte Carlo, we've tested and it's pretty good. We understand the way the Fermi lattice sees and reconstructs the showers and the calorimeter very well. So it comes out of a classification tree that was trained on the Monte Carlo. So if we believe the Monte Carlo, then yes, this variable should be fine. Right. So unfortunately, there aren't sharp features in the gamma ray spectrum, so we can't validate it on data. You know, I tried to see if I could measure this by looking at the exponential cutoff or the spectral cutoff of Vela. So the Vela kind of cuts off pretty hard around 10 GeV. And I looked at that and I couldn't really come up, I could not get a very statistically significant measure of the difference between the low or the high probability events on the spectrum. That's something that of course can be looked at again, you really need to be looking at spectral features that are very dependent on the energy resolution. So something that's smooth like a power law, the shape of that isn't really gonna change too much if you use the poorly reconstructed versus the high reconstructed energies. But like I said, this hasn't really been validated on the data because we don't have a sharp line from 20 MeV and above to 300 GeV to calibrate on. And we're really basing a lot of this off the Monte Carlo. But I repeat that the Monte Carlo, we do believe it very well because we did test it in beams here on Earth. And so beams that went up to 300 GeV or 280 GeV, electron beams. So I wouldn't invalidate the Monte Carlo too quickly.
And then a second question, I guess you could look at those, you know, that peak area, so, you know, 15 events in that area, and look at the side band and compare the probability that you gave to those two.
Right, although with 15 events, it's kind of hard.
Well, depends on how funny it is, right?
That's true. But you see, the difference, I guess, in the significance isn't, you know, we're talking about maybe half a sigma, but.
Right.
But no, you're right. You could look at that. That is something you could do.
What are the error bars on the data point?
Just for the kind of Poisson error bars from.
Yeah, but what is it? Is it one sigma, three sigma?
One. I mean, I do not offer this as conclusive evidence that this is not a actual line. I just offer this as evidence that this feature isn't really behaving the way that we would expect a line to behave given our Monte Carlo simulation of how we reconstruct the energy of an event. Really, like, my message is just one of skepticism at this point. All right, so something else we've looked at, and I mentioned that at this point this analysis is very qualitative and it needs to be quantified. But we look at the spatial morphology of where features near 100, you know, the 135 feature is coming from. We can look at what we do is we fit in these little 4x4 degree squares all along the galactic plane. And then we take the fit significance and plot that on the z-axis here. And really, I want you to take this fit significance with a grain of salt. What it really should just be showing you is where are these narrow residuals coming from. And I show you a fit for looking for narrow residuals at 136 GeV. And you can see it's localized kind of in the galactic center, which is what other people have shown. It seems like maybe there's three kind of blobs. And depending on which region of interest you pick, you know, say you only include this much or this much, or just focus in on this guy, you know, your significance of your fit's going to start to change. But then if you go and you do the same kind of fit at 93 GeV, you can see these similar, what I can call hot spots, or these similar parts where you see these narrow residuals, but they're just not in the galactic center. And so if you expect dark matter to be in the galactic center, then yeah, you're going to find this 135 feature. But if then you went looking for a 93 GeV feature, and you picked, say, this region of interest, then you're going to find a narrow residual there as well. So the point is just that the feature at 135 is one of the largest, and it's localized in the galactic center, but it's not that unique. And again, I repeat that this is really qualitative at this point, and we're hoping to quantify this with future studies. Okay, finally, let's talk about the Earth limb. This is a very important control region for a line search. So the Earth limb is created, so we get gamma rays from cosmic ray interactions in the upper atmosphere, and then those create gamma rays that are observed by the LAT. So this should be a smooth power law. Okay, your cosmic ray injection spectrum, we've measured that. Cosmic ray spectrum here, like at Earth, and it should be a power law. So if you wanted to say, how well can Fermi measure a power law, this is the place to look. Also, the limb is the brightest gamma ray source that Fermi sees, because it's right there in the atmosphere. And so that way it can be used to study some instrumental effects. Although even so, we make a cut when we observe the limb and we look at data from the limb. We specifically pick times when the Fermi LAT was pointing at the limb. So you'll remember that a lot of those instrument response functions were dependent on the incident angle of the event. Normally, the LAT's pointing away from the limb, so normally limb events come in at very high incident angles. So if you look at all of the limb events, you are not looking at events that were being observed the way that Fermi is observing the galactic center. So you really want to make this cut where you say, OK, I'm only going to look at times when Fermi was pointing at the limb, so that Fermi was looking at the limb the same way it looks at the galactic center, and I'm kind of comparing apples to apples as far as kind of instrument-based space goes. And of course, since Fermi doesn't look at the limb very often, when you make this cut, the number of events you have goes down. All right, and just to show you how bright the limb is, this is a distribution of the zenith angle. So this is usually, this is how you can define what the limb photons are. You look from about 111 to 113, and this is just a counts map, and there's the limb. Like, the number of events we're getting from this are very, very bright. So it's an easy source to identify. All right, so we look in the limb, and we see a narrow residual. Mind you, at a smaller level, the fractional size is smaller. But we see a narrow residual at exactly the same energy that we see the one in the galactic center. And that's weird. We shouldn't be seeing any narrow residuals in the limb. The limb should be this beautiful, smooth power law. So seeing residuals anywhere in the limb kind of gives you an idea of what are the size of effects that you can just get from sort of instrumental uncertainties. And this is just a fit for the 135 line in the limb data. And what this plot is showing is it says, OK, well, what if I took the limb data with my loosest set of cuts, we call that transient, to the clean cuts? What's the efficiency of going from transient to clean? What percent of events do I keep using these tighter cuts? Look at that as a function of energy. The red line is what we'd expect from Monte Carlo. The black line is what we see in the data. So you can start to see these, and they're not very statistically significant. But you can see these slight dips in efficiency right above and below 135 GeV. So if you imagine the cuts were suddenly getting tighter and then loosened at 135 and then got tight again, you could artificially create a spectral feature like a line. And this is something that we've been looking at for a long time to try to really narrow down, like, what variables are doing this. And those investigations are still under progress. But I just show you this plot as just, you know, beware that these effects can happen. And that we try not to artificially create spectral features. You can see our Monte Carlo, we wouldn't predict this problem at all. But then when you actually apply it to the data, things can happen. So, and again, I just want to point out that the feature we see in the limb is maybe a fractional size of about 15%. And the feature you see in the galactic center, depending on your region of interest, can be like 50% or 60%. So the feature in the limb is smaller than what we see in the galactic center. And so if you take that at face value, whatever is causing this feature in the limb, it's not accounting for all of the feature in the galactic center. But it is concerning that they're occurring at the exact same energy. Okay, just really quick, because I am out of time. We do have some great upgrades coming up. We do have a weekly pulse stare that's going to increase our limb data set at these lower incident angles. So we hope that exploring the limb is going to get better because we'll have more data. And if this feature persists and gets bigger and bigger, then that's going to be more evidence towards an instrumental cause at 135 GeV. If it goes away, then that would be pretty good for the people in the dark matter interpretation camp. We also had this thing called PASS-8, which is going to be the next pipeline upgrade that we're working on. We're doing everything from the event reconstruction up, and we're doing things much more cleverly. For example, in the calorimeter analysis, we don't usually account for pileup right now, or we throw pileup events away. So typically, we want snapshots where there's only one gamma ray in the event, but we have this issue with pileup that we weren't really expecting. Or say we take a snapshot, we trigger, we say, oh, there's a gamma ray, but also in the snapshot is this cosmic ray. And right now we're reconstructing these things as if they were one event. And so in PASS-8, we're going to be able to separate those and say, okay, well, here's the stuff from the cosmic ray, ignore that, and just use these guys to reconstruct the gamma ray. And so this is going to really help our acceptance. It's also going to give us a better handle on systematics. So PASS-8 is really going to be great, and we hope that it's going to be available for use on the public data in a year and a half to 2 years. But we expect a significant increase in acceptance. It's going to extend our energy reach. And so we hope that when we use PASS-8 on a line analysis, it'll help clear things up. All right, so I've hit my summary. I'm sorry I've gone over time. But the Fermilat team, we've looked for dark matter in a variety of ways. And so far, we haven't seen any convincing signals. And so we've set very strong limits. And we are starting to probe a very interesting region of WIMP phase space. We confirm the positron rise that Pamela saw. We also, in our line analysis, right now we do not see any globally significant lines, and we've uncovered some evidence that I think would make you be skeptical of interpreting it as a dark matter line at this time. However, there are still unanswered questions. For example, this is an instrumental effect. Why is it only showing up in the galactic center? Why would there be a spatial preference? And that's a great question that we don't have an answer for right now. And we hope to in the future with more rigorous systematic studies. And also we're doing pulse stares that are going to increase our limb data set. And we have PASS-8 coming down the line that's going to help increase the number of events that we get to use in our samples and also our handle on systematics. And so I just leave you with saying that our current searches are already starting to explore, you know, right around that thermal relic cross-section in a large range of wind masses. And our sensitivity just keeps getting better. Our understanding of the backgrounds keeps getting better. So you should stay tuned for more great results from the Fermi Large Area Telescope. Thank you for listening, and I'll take questions.
The confirmation of the Pamela positron fraction increase. I mean, from what I remember of the graph, I mean, you saw a little bump, but it looked like it went way down. I mean, how strong a confirmation is that? It looks to me like it could be consistent with nothing within limits of error, but I'm not the person who does it.
Well, I mean, so the gray bands here, I think, are supposed to represent our, the, like,
okay,
one thing,
so
one
thing. So there was another one where there was a big bump, but it shrunk to a little red one.
Right, so this is the electron and positron spectrum added together.
So when you do it, when you analyze properly, you get the next graph?
And the next graph is a different analysis.
Okay.
Where you say, how many positrons do I see at this energy versus how many electrons do I see at this energy?
All right, okay, I'm sorry.
So it's kind of a population study.
Right. So that is significant.
Yeah, I would say. Okay. And it does agree pretty well with the Pamela results as well.
Okay. All right.
But yeah, I do agree that the electron-positron spectrum, yeah, this isn't a very broad excess. And I guess maybe at the two sigma level, it seems to be consistent with maybe what Attic was seeing within their error bars. But it definitely looked like Attic was seeing something pretty narrow, and we don't confirm that.
Okay.
Any other questions? I'm around until 4:30 today. I think I'm up on the fourth floor at 476, so if you wanted to ask me any questions, you can grab me right now, or I'll be around until 4:30.
Thank you.